civil rights laws passed in the 1960s aimed to put an end to racial segregation in the United States in schools, housing, public services, and employment. Previously legal barriers to integration were torn down.
But even with those changes in the law, segregation didn't go away. In many parts of the country, researchers have found that schools are as segregated as they were in the 1960s. And many communities in the country still see sharp divisions of black and white neighborhoods, with the Milwaukee metropolitan area ranked as the most segregated in the country.
In a recent piece in The Atlantic, our next guest asks why segregation is hanging around decades after massive changes in civil rights laws. Adia Harvey Wingfield is a professor of sociology at Washington University in St. Louis. She's the author of the book No More Invisible Man, Race and Gender in Men's Work. Adia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm happy to be here.
So the laws that allowed legal segregation changed, but real life segregation remains. Why is that?
Well, there's a lot of research that looks at that and finds that while the laws have stopped allowing segregation to continue explicitly, a lot of the processes that maintain segregation and racial inequality at large continue to manifest themselves. So while it's no longer legal for people to say, I explicitly will not sell my house to someone who's a racial minority, a lot of the practices that are in place that make it more difficult for people of color, black Americans in particular, to have access to higher credit, have access to higher amounts of money for down payments, or to be able to be in the know about access to real estate, or to have connections to real estate agents who may or may not steer them to certain areas of the city that they want to live in, can still be an issue. So it's still not a matter of just having enough money to live in the area where you want to. Other structural processes come into play that can still make it difficult for racial integration to really occur in neighborhoods.
And you write that decisions made by possibly well-meaning white people who have no conscious intention to recreate segregation can lead to neighborhood segregation. How does that play out?
Right. There's an excellent book that talks about this in a lot of detail. It's by Thomas Shapiro, and it's called The Hidden Cost of Being African American. And one of the things that Shapiro finds in his book is that for many white families, there's no obvious overt intention to say, I'm simply not going to live in a diverse neighborhood. Some people will even say explicitly that they want diversity in neighborhoods. But then what happens is that people make choices about their home ownership, and they make choices about where they want to live. And a lot of that is driven by educational opportunities, or what they perceive to be educational opportunities available for their children. But many times, rather than taking into consideration factors like class size or teacher quality, things that are proven to make a difference in educational mobility and educational attainment, people racialize school choice, and they decide that the schools that they want their children to attend are schools that are primarily white and in certain neighborhoods that are racially exclusive. So what happens is that Shapiro finds that often white families make decisions that are coded by virtue of things related to race and class and don't really reflect accurate measures of school success, and that those decisions lead them to make choices about where they want to live in ways that reproduce racial segregation. They look for predominantly white neighborhoods because they believe that predominantly white neighborhoods equal better neighborhoods, and that predominantly white schools equal better schools. That's not always the case, but often that becomes the decision-making factor that drives how people make choices about their residential patterns, and that ends up reproducing the racial segregation that persists.
Now, through that piece in The Atlantic I mentioned, you are in some ways implicitly, maybe directly, arguing against ideas that, well, this is some kind of pathology, maybe a culture of poverty, as people used to call it, something that comes from African-American people themselves. Do you think that that argument, first of all, is commonly made as a reason for this sort of unintentional segregation?
Yeah, I do think that we still see echoes of people who persist in endorsing or perpetuating the culture of poverty argument, but I don't think that, at least in the data and research that I've seen, there is necessarily a lot of support for the merits of the culture of poverty argument. I think that if you look at the research on neighborhood segregation and residential patterns, I think that you're much less likely to see cases where there are people of color who persist in living around each other and not adopting the correct or appropriate values that lead them to experience economic or residential mobility. But often what happens is that people still persist in using racial stereotypes. People rely on what they think that they know about people of color, racial minorities in particular, and that drives a lot of housing patterns and a lot of housing decisions, much more so than the culture of poverty arguments.
You mentioned your connections to a network, knowing a real estate agent who would be willing to point you toward, nudge you toward one neighborhood or another. You also, in your piece, mentioned that sort of networking, that connection issue when it comes to finding jobs. So talk about how that plays out.
Right. One of the things that I've learned from doing my own research and reading that of my colleagues is that social networks matter enormously in shaping access to work. And this happens when we're talking about professional occupations. This happens when we're talking about non-professional occupations. And that many times, because our social networks often remain very racially exclusive, people of color can easily become locked out of the access to, or the networks to allow them to access particularly high-profile professional positions that will facilitate upward mobility. So while we like to think of jobs as being things that are driven solely by merit and driven solely by the best person being the one who gets the job for which they apply, often that's not necessarily what happens. In many cases, people's connections, the presumptions that employers and managers have about who's, quote, a good fit, the idea of what sociologists describe as soft skills, the ability to seem like you're a person who fits a job, the ability to seem like you're a person who has certain intangible qualities, can really work to disadvantage people of color in jobs where they're in the minority.
And on top of all that, you point out that white people tend to be economically better off than African Americans, and that allows white parents to pass that on to their kids to get them set up in education, mortgage, what have you.
Right. If I can return to the Shapiro book, one of the things that I found most compelling about that book was that in addition to what I just described in terms of white families using schools and the racial and class compositions of schools as kind of a shorthand for school success, the other thing that facilitates segregated neighborhoods or the persistence of segregated neighborhoods is that due to the transfer of intergenerational wealth, white families are often able to draw from extended family members, parents, grandparents, whomever, who can pass down sizable sums that then become used as a down payment or used as money for even college loans or to finance large expensive things that then don't become things that people have to take out loans for. For people of color, particularly those who are professionals or in the middle class, and particularly African Americans, often that's not the case. Instead of a vertical transfer of wealth, what we often see is something that operates at a more horizontal level, whereas if someone is a professional, someone works at a professional white-collar job, they may be more likely to have to loan money or give out financial gifts to siblings, to cousins, to aunts and uncles, to parents if they're Black American. And what that does is that means that person then has a lower amount of money saved that they can then use to put down as a down payment for a house and then reduce their interest payments on that house and move into the neighborhood of their choosing. So this idea of the intergenerational transfer of wealth and the ways in which white families are advantaged, I think really couples with the preferences or the racialized preferences about schools and neighborhood choice that help to keep segregation ongoing in residential areas.
Talking to Adia Harvey-Wingfield from Washington University about why segregation persists over five decades after laws that were supposed to end it. And Adia, so it was a huge effort to change laws to get to the Civil Rights Act of the 1960s, and that still didn't do the job. So what, given that, what would have to change to end the practical neighborhood segregation, school segregation, economic segregation we see in this country?
Right. Well, that's the million-dollar question. That clearly the laws that were passed in the 1960s, I think, reflected a lot of the racial practices that were prevalent and widespread previous to or prior to that time period. They reflected the fact that overt segregation was commonplace and very widespread in many places. They reflected the ways in which those rules about overt segregation led to overt practices where people couldn't access jobs, housing, public spaces, and so forth. We don't have that at this time period, but what we do have are covert practices that still reproduce a lot of those same outcomes. So some of the research that I've done talks about the challenges that Black professionals face in predominantly white occupational settings, where, again, no one will say explicitly, we're not going to hire you, but people still operate based on stereotypes in terms of hiring, in terms of decisions about who might be management material, in terms of decisions about who is a colleague with whom someone wants to work, and so forth. So I think that one of the things that's happening right now that's useful is that there are more social movements where people are drawing attention to the persistence of these types of issues. People often are critical of the Black Lives Matter movement, but I think one of the things that's valuable about that movement is that it does draw attention to the persistence of racial inequality in many different subsets and many different forms. I think that we also see examples of students of color on college campuses today who are protesting and drawing attention to the types of challenges and inequities that they face. Again, they get criticized because people perceive them as being whiny or being spoiled or being too coddled or not wanting to engage in dialogue. But one of the things that is valuable about what they're doing is that they're drawing attention to the ways that these issues continue to perpetuate themselves. So I think that with more visibility, this becomes a way for us to crystallize and identify what the issues are now, the ways in which they're manifested, and then to enact public policy and law that can reflect the contemporary manifestations of inequality.
Adia, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
That was Adia Harvey Wingfield, professor of sociology at Washington University in St. Louis, talking about the persistence of segregation. She had a recent piece in The Atlantic about that, and she's the author of the book, No More Invisible Man, Race and Gender in Men's Work.